Yes, what I'll do today, to in the time that we've got before Bante comes, is give some idea of the progress of Dr. Ambedkar's life to the point of conversion and beyond, as it were. Obviously, I'm not going to give a potted biography. There's just not enough time. And anyway, you can more easily read that. But what I want to do is give an idea of the sort of sweep of his life and how that, there's a logic to its unfoldment that leads up to his conversion, which sort of makes sense of what that conversion signified to him. So he's born in 1891 in Maharashtra. Actually, he was not. He was born in what is now Madhya Pradesh, but moved very soon to Maharashtra, the state that's now Maharashtra, the area that's now Maharashtra state, around Bombay. his parents were Mahars, that is one of the largest untouchable castes in that area of India. But his father had been a soldier in the British military and had achieved high non-commissioned rank. The British then, under pressure from high caste influence, stopped using Mahar soldiers. They had used the Mahar regiments, particularly to defeat the old Brahmin Peshwas of Pune. The Peshwas probably had the most intense casteist regime of India. The famous one where untouchables had to wear bowls around their necks to spit in, had to have a broom behind them to get rid of shadows, of footprints. But the British obviously relied upon high caste support in order to rule India, and they were susceptible to that sort of pressure, so they stopped using untouchable soldiers, who, with quite a bit of regret, because they were very good soldiers. Fortunately, the British government tended to be quite responsible in relation to those who'd served it. So Dr. Ambedkar's father was found a position as a storekeeper. I mean, not just a man at the door, but a man responsible for warehouses and so forth. So quite a responsible position. So although he came from that untouchable background, he'd got a certain degree of education. Doesn't mean university or perhaps even high school, but he could read and so on. Good morning. Good morning. So we're talking about Dr. Ambedkar's life. I have to speak slowly and clearly, or else with a strong Indian accent, which Janosz says he can understand very much better. So, so he had a fair amount of education and a high value of education, and a bit of a, you know, sort of upright military attitude to life. And he insisted on his children getting education. even though he had that sort of background and was a man of dignity and so on, Dr. Ambedkar, as the young Bhimrao, experienced untouchability a little bit. I mean, quite painful ways, but not in a sort of everyday way that people would in the villages. There's several stories he tells of his experiences of untouchability. For instance, not being able to easily interact with others at the school. There's a famous story of everybody bring their tiffin, their lunchbox, to school. And so he brought his with everybody else, and the tiffins were kept behind the blackboard at the front of the class. So he put his there, but the other students became very, very upset because, of course, the presence of his tiffin polluted all their tiffins, and they couldn't eat it. So he wasn't allowed to do that. Yeah? Anything is understood? A little bit? You can understand a bit? Yeah? Yeah? Aniko? You'd say yes anyway, wouldn't you? You're not an Indian. There are several other stories, but I won't tell them. However, what really comes down to is that he had very strong personal experience of untouchability, although at the same time he had a dignified and ethical upbringing. His father was a follower of Kabir, the medieval Indian mystic saint, who is a sort of universalist, and gives very basic ethical teachings of a kind of strongly reminiscent of Dhammapada at times. And I believe is one of those representatives of underground influence of Buddhism in India. Buddhism sort of disappeared from India, but it left traces in Indian culture which come out in particular teachings. Anyway, that's, be that as it may, his father was a follower of Kabir, so he had a strong ethical and spiritual impetus which he passed on to his children. The young Bhimrao was obviously exceptionally bright and intelligent, and made an impression on especially a Brahmin teacher. Again, this is quite a common story in these sort of situations that, you know, shows that, you know, Brahmins shouldn't be presented in one light. And this man, you know, very impressed by the young Bhimrao, and helped him a considerable amount, and with other help, got him into eventually secondary education and then university education in Bombay. And he procured, the young Bhimrao procured a grant from a princely house. Because remember, in British India, there was the part that was directly administered by Britain, but there was quite a substantial part, I think it's more than a third, which was administered directly by Indian princes under British control. Some of those princes were exceptionally philanthropic. Some of them were the very opposite. But he was particularly supported by a prince who has an important place in the sort of pantheon of the new Buddhist movement, Chhatrapati Shahu Maharaj of Kolhapur. It's a small city-state of which he was the absolute ruler, with a British resident to make sure that he acted properly, so to speak. He's a very philanthropic man, is also a huge man apparently, very tall and strong, and is reputed to have wrestled a tiger single-handed. And if you go to his palace now, it's full of tiger's skins and so on. So he was a traditional aristocratic ruler, but at the same time with a strong sort of philanthropic element. He was from a caste called Maratha, which is actually the largest caste in Maharashtra. They consider themselves to be Kshatriyas, warriors. But one day, when he was taking his ritual bath, he noticed that his Brahmin priests were missing some of the Vedic mantras that should be chanted for that occasion. And when he looked into it, what he found was that the Brahmin priests did not regard him as a Kshatriya. They regarded him as a Shudra. And so they would not give him the proper Vedic rites. So this sort of raised his consciousness, you could say. He suddenly realized what caste did. And from then on, he became virulently anti-caste. And in a very, very impressive sort of way. For instance, he had a servant who was an untouchable, a Maha, and when this servant retired, he set him up with a tea shop outside the gates of his palace, and whenever he went on shikari, on hunting expeditions, he would force all his palace servants to stop and take tea there, thereby polluting themselves. Which is interestingly enough, Goenkaji, when we went to see him, he said that he deliberately has Buddhists, in the sense of ex-untouchable Buddhists, working in the kitchens in his retreats. Anyway, Shahu Maharaj you know, did a huge amount for the people of his own state and deliberately tried to raise people up through education and so on. And he supported promising young untouchables in their education, and he gave some support to Dr. Ambedkar, and later got his cousin, the Maharaja of Baroda, in what's now Gujarat, to support him further. So the young Bhimrao showed exceptional promise, got a good education, a BA education in Bombay, and then was given a scholarship by the Maharaja of Baroda on the understanding he'd come back and serve in the Maharaja's administration. And he went off to Columbia University in New York State in America to do his MA and his doctorate. Very, very widely learned man, Dr. Ambedkar, even by this stage, had read very widely in European literature, in philosophy, in sciences, in law, and he continued this very broad range of interests. He hadn't been allowed initially to study Sanskrit, so he'd had to take Persian, because that's one of the classical languages behind Indian culture. He writes of his feelings as he left India, you know, on the boat, a sudden sense of sort of liberation and rising above his circumstances, but also a very strong sense of his obligation to others within that community. This is something, again, that from a Western point of view, it's hard to keep hold of. In a traditional society, you see yourself mainly in terms of relationships. And Dr. Ambedkar never lost that sense of his connection to his own people, as he would put it, in a very strong and clear way, all the time. He saw himself as going to get himself an education for the sake of his people. He came back from America. He spent some time in India, in UK as well. Studied at LSE, London School of Economics, and Gray's Inn. I'm afraid I can't remember the sequence in which he got all of his doctorates, but he ended up with three doctorates. A doctorate in law, a doctorate in economics, and a doctorate in D.Litt. Yeah. It's an honorary doctorate he was given later. And he was called to the bar eventually, a second return to England, to serve as a barrister, an advocate in the law courts. So a man gaining a huge wealth of knowledge and qualification, came back to India in 1917 and went to Baroda to serve out the agreement of his scholarship, as it were. The idea was that he would become the military secretary to the Maharaja. The Maharaja had his own small army, and no doubt mainly for ceremonial purposes and very much officered by Brits. But he was to be the military secretary. So a position of considerable responsibility, minister of defence, if you like, in the Diwan, the government of the Maharaja of Baroda. Quite a big state. But as soon as he got there, he began to encounter horrible experiences of prejudice. Because you imagine, an untouchable, absolutely unthinkable, wearing a suit and a tie and walking into the offices, expecting to sit behind the biggest desk, as it were, in that quarter of the office, and others have to serve him. He'll have an undersecretary, he'll have various clerks, he'll have peons, that's office servants, all of whom would be caste Hindus. And they didn't like it. They didn't like it one bit. He wasn't, when he went to the club, you know, the colonial style club for the officers of the Diwan, it was very clear that he was being given separate treatment. They couldn't stop him coming, but they made sure that he had his own glass, his own water and so forth. He didn't pollute others. Oh, that's right, they had a water cooler in the office. Everybody just go and scoop some water and drink it. And after he got there, it disappeared, because clearly he was going to pollute it. Even his peons, who are completely illiterate office servants, wouldn't come with the files that they were transferring, you know, from one desk to his desk. They would stand at a safe distance in the doorway and throw them onto his desk. And so on. He couldn't find anywhere to stay because the word had gone around that he was an untouchable. He eventually went to a Parsi, that's Zoroastrian hostel, as there's people of Persian origin settled in India to escape Muslim persecution. It's a small religion, but quite strong one in India, and very wealthy and quite sort of confident and proud. So there was a hostel for Parsis. And he passed him. He didn't exactly say he was a Parsi, but he didn't exactly say he wasn't. And he was put up in the hostel. After a while, the word got round that he was an untouchable, and so Parsis, who are not Hindus and not part of this system, threw him out. And there's a very, very moving incident in his life. You know, he come back, this highly qualified man, one of the most qualified, probably in the D1, if not the most qualified in the D1, with high prospects. He thought at that stage what he could do was, you know, get into, he could integrate and show the way for others by showing that an untouchable could become a government servant of a high order and so forth. He thought that would sort of open the way for others. But very clear it wasn't that easy. And so he left the hostel, and he describes how he didn't know where to go. He decided he could not go back into the office. He just so humiliated by what had happened. He went into a small park nearby, and he just had to wait until the train left later in the day. And he describes how he just sat under this tree, completely humiliated, and weeping, and deeply frustrated. And our own people in Baroda, the TBMSG people in Baroda, have got the state government and the city government to make that place into a sort of a pilgrimage site, as it were. And I gave a talk there in December. And lots of people came. It's very, very moving. You can see that tree where he just sat, and you can imagine him in his suit and his tie and his briefcase and so forth and all his luggage, just thinking, you know, what has been the point of these last years? What's the point of it all? And he seems to have come to a sort of decision in that situation. He just realised that the line he'd been going on wasn't going to work. It might work for him if he could sort of pass himself off. But even that wasn't really going to work. People weren't going to accept it. So he seems to have made a sort of vow, you could say, that he was just going to dedicate everything, not to his own progress as a means of uplifting others, but to directly fighting for the uplift of others. From then on, he did go back to England after that, got further qualifications, went to Germany briefly, to Bonn University, came back to India, and continued the struggle in Bombay. He was trying to get his own legal practice going. He became an advocate in the Bombay High Court, a barrister in the Bombay High Court. It was a very prestigious position. Very difficult for him to get cases. Who's going to give a case to an untouchable? Although his extraordinary gifts began to mean people did give them to him, because they're more interested in winning their case than in untouchability, if you see what I mean. But not many. I should mention, by the way, that before he went to India, he'd been married at the age of a very young age. I can't remember what age it would have been. 16. His wife was 12, and had all through this period some children. Many died, of course. Later he expressed quite considerable regret, because he felt that in struggling to establish himself, he'd sort of neglected the needs of his family, and his he felt some sort of guilt over that. But in a way, his sort of sights were on a larger issue, and in the course of that, he wasn't able, and probably that's realistic, to give them the attention that they needed. And sometimes, of course, that even meant economic hardship. He was struggling to establish himself in the courts, fighting a lot of battles on behalf of downtrodden people, trying to get them their justice, as it were. He was also involved in labour organisation, and he was one of the forces behind the huge Bombay mill workers strikes, which were a key sort of point in the history of labour rights in India. He joined forces with the communists, and it's fairly obvious at that time that his inclinations were towards a strongly left-wing political position, not communist, but sort of influenced by Marx and the sort of socialist thinking. He was sort of thinking very much in those kind of terms. And I would say that at this point, this is my interpretation, but that it's quite strongly influenced by a sort of Western, you know, post-European Enlightenment perspective. The political perspectives of the modern West. He'd been deeply impressed by America, partly because he just felt so free. The first time in his life, nobody saw him as untouchable. And, you know, in a place like Columbia University, there wouldn't have been much racial prejudice. And even in England, one of the extraordinary things is that many Indians I've read, coming to England in the early part of the 20th century, commented on how welcome they were and how freely they were treated. It was different when they met white people in England, in India. There they would not be acknowledged. And one of the things that people were quite shocked by was that they'd make quite close friends with white people in England, but then when those white people came to India, they wouldn't acknowledge them. So he experienced both in America and in India quite a bit of sort of personal freedom. We're very impressed by the American Constitution and the whole sort of spirit and mood of the United States. So he got a sort of leftist position, although at the same time he was a lawyer with a very strong belief in constitutional principles and legal principles. All his life, although he'd come quite close to being forced, so to speak, by frustration to break the law, he refused to do so. He believed that law was vital to a just society. It was one of his main quarrels with the Gandhians. He believed that Gandhi's refusal to accept what he considered to be, on the whole, reasonable British law, he felt that would breed into India a disregard for law. And to be honest, he's right. He was agitating in various ways, mainly through untouchable organisations, but other leftist organisations, forming his own social and cultural and even political organisations, working with others, broadly in harmony with the growing independence movement, with the spirit of that, although with an increasing disquiet. He began to increasingly feel that the independence movement was dominated by caste interests which were more interested in getting rid of the British than in ending the social injustices that dominated India. And he said, you may be getting independence for yourselves, but you'll be deepening our enslavement. Because under the British, even though they did not really do enough, at least there was a framework of law that was administered by, it's generally acknowledged, pretty impartial British officials. The political level, it's a different story, but at the local level and at the legal level and so forth, they were pretty impartial. And, you know, once you remove that protection, what's it going to be like for us, Dr. Ambedkar said. And this became an increasingly sort of hot dialogue as time went on. We'll see this unfolding. But to begin with, he shared the objectives. He wanted to get rid of the British. He thought it was wrong that one nation should rule another, obviously. But it was not so much that he wanted them to go. He was concerned about the manner of their going. He wanted to make sure that there was a real change in Indian society before the relative safeguard that the British gave was removed. Passive safeguard, as it were. He didn't want to suggest that they did enough by any means. In fact, he was strongly critical of the British administration for not dealing with this injustice. So he began to increasingly focus on the need to challenge the limitations on untouchables' capacity to operate within society. And he began to use satyagraha, non-violent demonstration, as a way of making the point. Satyagraha. It's a Gandhian term, actually. Well, I mean, a term that Gandhians use. I mean, satya, truth. Graha means action. Truth action. Yeah. Yeah? Something like that? Yeah. Grasping at truth, I suppose, would be the literal meaning. It's taken to mean that, yeah. Yeah. You use truth as the means of getting what you believe to be proper. Hmm? No trouble. You've just thrown me off my plan, but that's okay.
I'm not rich.
I know. I think we understand each other. So he took up particularly two issues, or rather, others were taking up one issue, and he joined in with that. Others were taking up the issue of temple entry, because untouchables were not allowed into Hindu temples. And as I told you, that's still the case. Not many, but it's still the case. And he particularly became involved in a struggle in Nashik in northern Maharashtra to gain entry to the Kalaram temple. I recently went there with a group of our friends, and two or three of them would not go in. They said, Baba Sahib was not allowed in, we will not go. And I went in with some others, and we looked around, and we went into the Sanctum Sanctorum, the inner temple. And as we were leaving, my friends shouted out, Jai Beam! So he was involved in that struggle. He wasn't that convinced by this particular struggle, but he sort of went along with it, and again pulled up short when the civil authorities forbade the demonstrations because of the disorder problems that engendered. I mean, civil authorities are not usually concerned with justice. They're concerned with order. And that was broadly the British position. And still the case in India, that there'd be a tendency to smooth over an atrocity case in the interests of supposed harmony. But what he particularly did, and this is a very important incident in his life, he led a large satyagraha at Mahad. There's a town, it's not a big town, in southwestern Maharashtra, where there was a large tank, that means reservoir, drinking tank, where the whole village would get its water, the whole town would get its water. And untouchables were prevented from drawing water from that well by the caste Hindus. It was a public well. It belonged to the municipality, and under the laws of the government of the area, the state government, the Bombay Presidency government, all public property had to be open to all. There couldn't be discrimination where public property was concerned. So Dr. Ambedkar went with a huge following, several thousand people, to gain access to that water. And they went, they drew water, and afterwards there was a huge violent attack upon them by caste Hindus. And as I told you, the water was then purified by putting cow dung in it, because that purified it of the touch of a human being. The civil authorities, in the interests of order, put an injunction on further untouchable drawing of water until the matter could be settled legally. Dr. Ambedkar came to challenge that a second time, a year or so later. And on this occasion, they were served notice by the local authority, the British officer, that they could not draw water. So he conducted a sort of symbolic act. There's lots and lots of these symbolic acts in Dr. Ambedkar's life. He's a master of the political social symbol, as it were. He formally had the Manusmriti burned on a very sort of ritualized context. I think it was actually Brahmin priests he got to burn it.
His
Brahmin friends, yeah. Well, all Brahmins are priests, so yes. So the Manusmriti is a medieval Indian document that codifies the caste system. And it prescribes very strictly the interrelations between the different castes. I mean, it's got some good common sense of social sense and so on. But when you read it, and there's a Penguin edition of it if you want to have a get yourself, you know, nicely riled up, it's horrifying. It's horrifying what's enjoyed. For instance, if a Shudra, not untouchable, if a Shudra hears the Vedas, he's to have molten lead poured in his ears. So it's the document that establishes, as it were, religio-legally, the caste system, and it's the basis for it. Many Hindus will deny that the Manusmriti is of this kind, but there's absolutely no doubt about it. So he burnt this document, or had burnt. He didn't do it himself. He deliberately got Brahmins to burn it. And he was supported in his work by a number of liberal-minded and open Brahmins, as always. This had a huge impact. Many people deeply, deeply upset at what he'd done. But it's obvious that for him it was a sort of liberation moment, a point when he really began to challenge the religious background of caste in a very, very clear and open way, and began to be increasingly sure that Hindus would not change. Because there were Hindus coming forward and saying, look, this is just added on to Hinduism. It's not Hinduism proper. Hinduism will change. But he began to be increasingly sure that Hinduism would not change, that this was sort of fundamental to it. The responses he got to so many of his actions made him increasingly sure that Hinduism had no capacity to change. So this is a milestone in his move. And it is interesting at that time that he took some of his followers to the Buddhist caves near Mahad. And he talked at that time very, very strongly, approvingly of the Buddha. We know that he knew of the Buddha very early on. One of his Brahmin teachers gave him a prize, a biography of the Buddha. I think at the age of about 14, 12, 14. He keeps on showing all through his life sort of hints of his regard for the Buddha. In naming his house in a way that suggested his interest in the Buddha. He talked at the Manusmriti Satyagraha of a threefold purification, body, speech and mind. So he clearly was reading up in Buddhism. We don't know so much about exactly what he was reading. We have his library still, but exactly what he was reading at which stage. But he clearly was reading up on Buddhism.
So we don't know when he becomes a practitioner.
No. I mean,
he's already I think at that time he's saying something like, I was born a Hindu.
But well, it's later. We'll come on to that later. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a sort of, there's obviously, he's, you know, he's got both a strong Western rationalist strand, which is mainly tied up with political and economic and social reform. But he's also got, in the background, his sort of Kabir Panthi training and his ethical perspective and a deep feeling for Indian culture. He loved Indian classical music. He was read Persian poetry, which is some of the most beautiful poetry, apparently, in Indian writing. Urdu, which is sort of comes on from Persian. So he's a cultured man and reading strongly in that background. And obviously beginning to get the idea that the issue is a religious one. To begin with, he's tackling it at the social and economic and political level. But there's in the background a sense that religion is what's at heart here. And the Manusmriti is the first public action that really betrays that. Oh dear, I've not got my dates here. When was the Pune Pact? No? Pune Pact. Huh? Yes, that's right. That would figure, yeah. So shortly after the Mahad tank, Dr. Ambedkar is recognised by the British as a leading representative of untouchables. And to give the British their due, at this time they're trying to give a measure of self-government to India. Dr. Ambedkar believes that we've got some notes he took for a paper he's going to write. He believes that the independent struggle complicated the issue. That actually the British were showing clear signs of recognising the limits of their ability to rule India. And they were under a strong pressure increasingly from internally from liberal and increasingly socialist forces in Britain, because there have been socialist governments, the Labour government, in the 30s in Britain. So there's a sort of move against the imperial enterprise, even within Britain, and strong sort of pressure from increasingly the most powerful nation, America, against the imperial enterprise. They were engaged in their own, but that's another matter. It's more thinly disguised, more disguised, thickly disguised. The Philippines know for themselves. So the British were recognising they needed to bring about a more representative government. They were aiming at dominion status, the status that Australia and Canada had from about this time. They wanted India to be an independent, self-governing nation under the British Crown. They almost certainly would have moved that way. And arguably, one of Dr. Ambedkar's arguments was that the precipitation of that process led to the catastrophe of partition. And Dr. Ambedkar's point of view on so many of these issues, like Kashmir, he foresaw what happened in Kashmir. And a very, very shrewd political observer. Anyway, he was invited along with other representatives like Muslim leaders, leaders of the independence movement and so on, to London to what was called a round table conference. Initially, the Congress leaders of the independence struggle refused to participate. But I think it's the second or third conference, the second conference, Gandhi did go as the representative of the independence movement. He strongly argued against Ambedkar's inclusion because he said, "I represent the untouchables." Now, this is a discourse that's a bit difficult for us Westerners because we have such a high regard for Gandhi, and in a way, rightly so, although perhaps we need to moderate that quite considerably. Gandhi abrogated to himself the representation of the entire Hindu fold and would have abrogated to himself the representation of the entire Indian people, including the Muslims, if the Muslims hadn't been stronger and had stronger British gut backing. And he was deeply unhappy with Dr. Ambedkar's inclusion in the mission. And constantly they clashed in the course of the discussion. And, when you read that we've got verbatim accounts of the discussion, You know, the two contrast so strongly. Gandhi, emotional, you know, highly idealistic, and with a strong element of a sort of implicit blackmail, a threat. Dr. Ambedkar, reasonable, detailed argument, quite highly critical, but in a very, very clear, rational way, and basing himself firmly on you know, the principles of a modern legal liberal representative democracy. The outcome of these roundtable conferences was what was known as a communal award. The British government agreed to bring about a greater degree of representation, to set up not just at the local level but at the state level state legislatures, which would have a fair degree of legislative independence under the Viceroy and his council. Qualified self-government, if you see what I mean. But in order to safeguard the interests of minorities, they were assigned special representation. So the Muslims had reserved seats. There were seats, reserved electorates rather, so that they had their own parliamentary representatives. They could themselves elect their own members of parliament, members of state legislatures. Dr. Ambedkar had argued that the untouchables were a minority which was independent of the larger Hindu majority. He said, how can they argue that we're Hindus when they won't let us in their temples? You know, when it comes to temples, we're not Hindus. When it comes to representation, we are. You know, come on. And put rather more reasonably than that, but very cogently. And he persuaded Ramsay MacDonald, the British Labour government Prime Minister, that this was a reasonable case. So Ramsay MacDonald and the British Cabinet gave to the untouchables separate electorates. They could elect their own representatives.
Can I ask about Gandhi's position with the untouchables and temple entry?
Gandhi's position was always ambiguous. I think probably instinctively he was against forbidding people entry to the temples. But of course he had to be careful because his major support came from caste interests. And there are occasions when he started off calling for temple entry and then sort of backed out of the issue. And that's a sort of, I mean, in a way you can understand, if he thought that independence was the most important issue, you can see that point. But also, Gandhi, you know, to be give my interpretation, was a romantic, and he believed in a perfect India of the past that somehow had been subverted. He thought of the Indian village as the perfect democracy, and you'll still get people saying, you know, India invented democracy. The Indian village is democratic. It is, as long as you're a Brahmin.
What caste was he from?
Who? Gandhi. He was from. He's a Bengal, a Gujarati Marwari, that is Vaishya trader.
He's ambiguous. He sort of.
Well, he believed in Varna, but he thought that there should be a fifth Varna, which the untouchables would be assimilated to, which he called the Harijan, which many considered to be deeply insulting, and because it sort of suggests they were special children of God, children of God, and therefore sort of needing special protection and care, not capable of looking after themselves. I mean, you know, you can take it from a position of complete objectivity, but you can also get inside and understand his position. But Dr. Ambedkar considered increasingly that Gandhi was an enemy, a sort of near enemy, because he was espousing independence before social democracy. He was strongly against the untouchables taking responsibility for themselves. For instance, he said, one of his arguments against Dr. Ambedkar coming is, we, the upper caste, created this problem. It's our duty to solve it. You leave it to us. But Dr. Ambedkar and others felt this was extremely patronising, and that it would leave them in a position of entire dependence. And Dr. Ambedkar increasingly said, no, we must do this. Because if you do it, you'll do it, you know, in this sort of patronising way, leaving us as children. And we're not children. We're going to stand up for ourselves. So the MacDonald had a...
Batty's coming in 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay.
Do you want to stop for a break before?
What do you want to do? 5 minutes break, 10 minutes break? Probably a good idea, isn't it, just to change the mood a bit? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll complete this particular point and then conclude for this part of the morning. So the award was made. And Gandhi completely rejected it. And he was in jail at the time, in Yeroda, near Pune, a suburb of Pune. And he went on a hunger strike to death. So he said...
He rejected
the award that the British government had made on the grounds that it gave to the untouchables a special status, which he considered divided the Hindu community. And in a way, you can see his point. It created further divisions. It's always the problem of affirmative action. And in a way, that is a problem now in India. Affirmative action has created a separation, and there's a lot of tension around it. But at the same time, it has created a huge evolution and development. Manidhammer's brother became a collector because of affirmative action. So Gandhi rejected this. And he went on a strike, a hunger strike. So you can imagine, Gandhi is the idol of the huge majority of the Indian population. He's going on a hunger strike against the wishes of the leader of a very large but still minority of the population. Ambedkar is an impossible position. He knew that Gandhi was quite capable of getting himself to death. He was, by the time that the whole thing was sorted out, he was extremely ill, and his doctors were very worried about him. Ambedkar said that on humanitarian grounds, what could he do? You know, here was a man dying, and it was in his hands to save him. So he felt under horrible pressure. At the same time, he knew that if he let Gandhi die, and for the sake of the principle, there would be a bloodbath. In every village, untouchables would be, at the very least, beaten up, and many would be killed.
It's paradoxical that Gandhi is seen as non-violent.
Yes, indeed.
Really using the threat of violence.
Yes.
And his self-harming.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot that we really need to understand about that. That non-violence is really the use of moral violence, if you see what I mean. You use people's moral feelings. And you force them to do what you think they need to do. There's a lot that can be said about that. And Dr. Ambedkar is extremely critical of what that's done to India. I mean, today, anybody who wants anything goes on satyagraha. And anybody who believes that they've been done an injustice breaks the law. I'm not really exaggerating. It's bred into India a disrespect for law, which Dr. Ambedkar foresaw. So, Gandhi and Dr. Ambedkar had to come to terms. Gandhi also travelled some distance. And what actually happened, we'll go into this afternoon. That's the story so far.